This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30,000 jobs to be cut at Ford Motor Company, 14 plants to be closed, and the great-grandson of founder Henry Ford says this is the way forward. Well, maybe. We'd better pray he's right, and we do. But if the way forward for American manufacturing is massive layoffs, massive shutdowns, collapsing market share, and big dreams, the American people have a right to ask what is going on. Sure, unemployment is low, but median income growth, the family take-home, is a lot lower. America is supposed to compete and win on the high-tech frontier, we're told. But if cars aren't high-tech enough these days, what is? Up next on Point, searching for the future of American manufacturing, of the American dream. Joining me from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Walter McManus, Director of Automotive Analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. Walter McManus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Hi. So here we are, big announcement from Ford. A couple days later, I'm reading Wall Street Journal saying, you know, they keep announcing these restructurings, and there's a moment of fleeting optimism. It reverts to pessimism. The plant closings and job cuts are unlikely to save the companies, says the Wall Street Journal. Is this going to work? Is there a chance?
Well, I would say that there is a chance, yes, you know, the auto industry, and it's really mainly these two companies and possibly a third, GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler, that are having difficulties.
And they're the big three.
Well, do you count Daimler Chrysler as one of the former domestic big three? I mean, we still call it that, but it's open to debate. But they're the ones that are in trouble, the former domestic giants of the auto industry. But I believe that their plans, I mean, GM announced one toward the end of last year, very similar to Ford's in some ways, plant closings, job reduction, but they are following some different strategies. And I'd like to, talk about Ford's, how what they're doing is a way forward.
Yes, please, because what we see is huge job cuts and plant closings, you know, much more way forward like this, and we'll all be dead. But, of course, that's not the goal. That's not the plan. What is the strategy here?
Well, they have too much capacity, and they need to get their company capacity in North America to the right size and also, to the right product mix. And one of the things that they was a big part of the announcement was some of the new products, the new technologies that Ford is leading the big three in, and that's hybrids, the hybrid technologies, also the flexible fuel vehicles. And, you know, this comes at a time when the oil prices, gasoline prices we face have been going up for several years now. The Energy Information Administration, part of the Department of Energy, last year raised their forecast of oil prices in the future.
So SUVs don't sell anymore. They're going to be leading in hybrid and flexible fuels among the big three, you say. But are they leading globally? I mean, the competition is global here.
And that's correct. The competition is global, and the competition is also here. You know, they have, since the 70s, the Japanese and the Europeans and now the Koreans have built manufacturing facilities here, and they are, the Japanese are ahead of Ford in the hybrid technology.
Mr. McManus, that brings us back to this question. You say they have to cut back because they have overcapacity. Of course, they have too much capacity because they're not selling more cars. The Japanese are. The trend lines for GM and Ford are down. For Japanese and others are up. So who's to say they're going to be able to sell the cars even at the cut-back capacity?
Well, they're selling the amount of cars today. And actually, even if they lose a couple of more points a share over the next 2 or 3 years, the new capacity that they announced will be able to be sold. They'll be, you know, if they are able to accomplish the reductions and get there, they will be selling those cars.
What's the guarantee of that? I'm looking at the trend lines. They're south, south, south. If Ford continues to go south in market share, and the management has not proven that it can do otherwise yet, and we've seen round after round of cutbacks, what's the guarantee that we just don't go to zero here? Is the Wall Street Journal
is saying today is still expected on Wall Street.
Well, they are going in a downward direction. They have been. But what I'm saying is mm-hmm. that the capacity cuts that they announced, mm-hmm. even if they lose 2 more points of market share, you got to remember they're only 17% market share. If they lose 2 more points, that's a big deal. But they will then have the right capacity at that time. Mm-hmm. And I agree with them. The future is going to be a leaner in terms of people wanting better fuel economy and more. Less greenhouse gases, less pollution.
I think we can all see that. I guess the question is, do they have time, Walter McManus, and do they have it in their bones to turn around? I mean, we've watched this decline for a long time now. Suddenly, it's not funny anymore. But do Ford and GM, and GM is worse off, do they have time to turn this around? The competition keeps coming.
Well, and that gets to the next point. I don't know that they have the time, and I also don't know that they have the resources. They need some help. This year Ford's product lineup, when you go in the showroom, is going to be 5 years old on average. Toyota's is about 2 years old. The design, how old the designs were.
Yeah.
And that gap, that's really important. They need to get faster refreshing of their products. And that takes lots and lots of money. They can't do both. They can't make this reduction in their size and invest in the technologies that they need to for the future. And I would say also for the future of our country. I mean, we want to be leaders in this country in these advanced technologies.
What are the odds we're going to be in the automotive transport front 10 years from now, as you judge it today?
Well, I think we have an opportunity right now. You know, this is one of those times that don't come along often in history where there are opportunities. I mean, there's a crisis, but within that there's an opportunity, and I believe that Ford is one of those that's seizing it. Last week, Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, also talked about the importance of investing in these new technologies because they see that that's where their jobs are going to be in the future. Mm. And Ford and the UAW are working very closely together. The historic deal that GM started with the healthcare cost sharing by the UAW,
mm-hmm.
Ford did it. And when Ford did it, the UAW insisted that it be turned into investments in advanced technology vehicles.
So there's an opportunity here, but the window is small, and as you say, there is no guarantee that Ford can turn it around in time, and that is scary. Walter McManus at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, we thank you very much for your insight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining me right now in the studio is Don Rosenfield. He's director of the Leaders for Manufacturing Fellows Program at MIT. He's a senior lecturer at the Sloan School of Management and the Engineering Systems Division at MIT. Don Rosenfield, thanks very much for being with us.
Good day. Thank you.
So, do we have a chance in manufacturing here? I mean, it's just getting to the point where you wonder, what on earth are Americans going to make that the rest of the world is going to buy in enough quantity that we can employ millions and millions of Americans at a decent and growing standard of living? Is that possible, or have we blown past that?
Well, manufacturing is still very important to our economy, and I think that manufacturing has done well in the last 20 years, and there's still the opportunity to continue to do well.
It's done well. From 1965 to 2005, the percentage of payroll employees devoted to durable goods dropped from 19% to 8%.
Right.
That doesn't sound good from a working man's point of view, and our trade deficits are hellacious.
Yeah, no, what you said is correct, but there are a couple of other trends that are going on here. Even though employment has gone down substantially, productivity has gone up. So the total value of the output has really only declined a little bit.
But what does that matter if our trade deficit's so bad and we don't have jobs? Okay, we've got productivity up, but where's the bottom line impact that we can put in the bank, that we can take home, that we can put clothes on the kids with?
There's obviously the service sector has increased substantially. If you compare what's happened in manufacturing to agriculture 100 years ago, most Americans lived on farms, and employment in agriculture went down substantially.
Can we migrate away from manufacturing in the same way and have a viable high-income economy?
Well, there are similarities, But as manufacturing employment goes down, we have to increase productivity substantially so that resources can be devoted to the service industry. There is an analogy to agriculture
there. Well, I'm not sure it's a comforting one, though. I mean, what we've seen, we've heard this for 20 years now, and what we've seen of service industry jobs is not exactly comforting. I mean, we've seen what happened with median income growth in this country. Absolutely stagnant. Don Rosenfeld, are they leading? I mean, are American managers leading manufacturing in an effective way? Yeah, it doesn't look like it in Detroit.
Well, it depends what you mean by American manufacturers. If you look at the auto industry, for example, GM and Ford have had tremendous are going through tremendous reductions in workforce. But what's happened over the last 20 years has been an enormous influx of foreign-owned manufacturers setting up shop in the United States.
Is that okay? Is it six of one, half dozen of the other? Does it matter if it's Toyota or Ford if you're working in Michigan?
It matters if you're working in Michigan. Overall employment in the auto industry has been roughly the same for the last 10 years or so.
Because the incoming foreign manufacturers are going to non-union states.
Exactly. But if you're working in Michigan, there have been huge disruptions. So the state of the auto industry is pretty robust. But it's come at the expense of Ford and GM.
I mean, we want this to work. We have to pray for it. But in very simple terms, what in this century is America going to make and sell to China? What are we going to sell in such a volume that we don't go perpetually further into the red? That we have humming factories in this country with people with good incomes.
Right.
What are we going to sell? What would you point to?
Well, you've brought up a good point there. The auto industry is actually quite different than other industries because for the last 50 years, while imports are a significant factor in terms of what people hear about in the press and so forth, the number of cars actually being imported is fairly small compared to the number of cars that are actually being produced here.
The number of cars being imported is small next to...
compared to what's produced here.
Because so much manufacturing has moved here.
Right, exactly. I mean, Toyota in 1970 exported all their cars to the United States. Now they build most of them.
Still, the profits from Toyota go to Japan. I mean, I know there are international shareholders there. Now China's getting ready with its $10,000 car. I mean, the question stands, I really want to know, what is it that we're going to make in this country and export to China, for example?
Well, I'm not sure how much we export to China because the trade deficit with China is pretty big. But if you look at manufacturing in the U.S., there are a number of other industries that are growing. So many are declining. There are different the types of products that Americans produce are products that are new industries that are innovative, biotech, things like that. Products where there's a lot of variety, where importing them requires too much inventory. So, for example,
One of a kind things.
Things that are customized. Dell Computer can produce in the United States because they're building to order and they're building a lot of variety. Although
assembling to order, in
exactly.
Case.
Much of the value added is brought over.
I'm not hearing much here yet. Some biotech, some made to order things.
Right.
What's going to float this economy?
And basically, innovative things in established industries. So the newest types of high-tech products.
Is that enough to put hundreds of millions of American families in a good situation for standard of living?
Well, regardless of what happens in terms of Americans' share of global manufacturing. Employment will go down because of productivity improvements. Okay, so there are a couple of things that have to happen. We have to continue to develop the service industry. We have to continue to develop new and innovative products, and then the economic gains will occur.
Is the service industry ever going to pay like dominant manufacturing would?
Not at the low end, but certainly there are jobs. Certainly there are a number of jobs in the service industry that could provide that.
But nothing like the workforce. I mean, the low end is a whole lot of people. It's most people, right, in the service industry.
I think that's right. There's certainly the service industry does not provide well as good manufacturing jobs. But Even if we do well in manufacturing, the direct employment in manufacturing will not be that large. But it's important to do that because if manufacturing, uh, if 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 we continue to rely on exports totally, the standard of living will go down. So we have to continue to be good at manufacturing, even if total employment in manufacturing goes down.
Here I am putting you on the hot seat, and I don't mean to be so combative, but this news just goes on and on year after year, and now we don't see service stepping up to support incomes in the same way. Let me ask you this. Looking at automotive, we hear all about it, but we're told Americans have to move up the ladder of innovation, up to higher tech products. But transportation these days is a very sophisticated field, and a very large one, where people all over the planet pay a lot of money for really sophisticated cars. So isn't that an industry that we have to be strong in if we're going to be strong in manufacturing globally? I mean, isn't that an example of high tech?
Oh, yes. No, we have to be good at manufacturing.
But I mean, automotive at manufacturing.
Right, automotive, absolutely.
But we're losing.
Well, it depends how you define it again.
Market share. What's simpler than that? It's going down, down, down. All the big three.
That's right. But again,
they're losing billions of dollars per quarter.
Well, the foreign transplants have about 20% of the workforce in the United States, and if their presence has to be counted. If Toyota and Honda and those companies are taking up the slack of GM and Ford, overall for the economy, that'll probably be okay. I think it is. I think it's important for GM and Ford to be strong, but it's more important for the auto industry as a whole to be strong.
Can we be the leading economy in the world if our people are working for manufacturers based elsewhere? Will we have the leading edge technology? Will we really be in a leadership position if American workers are working for Toyota and who knows what next, Chinese auto manufacturers in Georgia?
Well, it depends how far it goes. But if all of American auto workers are working for Toyota or Honda, I imagine that would create problems. But if still 50 to 75% of them are working for Ford and GM, I think that'll be okay.
And amazingly, as we sit here and talk today, that's a real if. People are talking about the very survival of these companies. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Ted is calling from Martinsburg, West Virginia. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi there. I used to be an auto worker.
Yes, sir.
I worked 20 years for them. And I'm listening to all these experts this morning, and every one of them sounds like they're lying through their teeth.
In what regard, Ted?
And it sounds like everybody's gotten together and collaborated, and what they're trying to do is tell everybody how wonderful things are going to be. All we have to do is get rid of all our manufacturing jobs. What's happening, the service industry, is hamburgers, is wiping cars down at lube shops.
Ted, why isn't the American automobile industry dominant? I mean, we started it. We've got all kinds of high-tech wizards.
Exactly.
We've got people who work hard, so why aren't we on top?
They don't want to be dominant anymore. They want to leave the country is what they want to do.
Leave the country.
Out of here so they don't have to pay the labor wages and the medical costs.
That's not what Mr. Ford says.
Well,
he says
of course he's not going to tell you that. He's too busy getting rid of his people, and staying with General Motors and all these other ones.
Ted, how's life been for you since you left the automobile business?
Terrible. I got pushed out.
And the wages?
Nothing. I'm retired now on Social Security.
Yeah, and that's Don Rosenfield. Here's Ted. What do you say to him?
Well, I don't think that people want to abandon the auto industry in the United States. It is true that there are some jobs. It's true that parts manufacturers are moving, and to some extent, it's inevitable. I mean, globalization. To some extent has created this problem. If you can produce something a lot cheaper overseas, you can't stop it, unfortunately.
But that inevitable part, I think, is what gets under Ted's skin. You're talking about his standard of living and millions of others. Inevitable that it decline?
Certain types of jobs. I mean, the final assembly and a lot of other value-added jobs in the auto industry will stay here, even if it's not Ford and GM. Parts manufacturing and other jobs will probably move.
Ted, how would you bring the auto industry back?
Well, the first thing you got to do is stop this hemorrhage of jobs out of the country.
You mean just pass a law and say they can't go?
If you want to sell the damn things here, you make them here.
That's pretty tough when we've been champions of free trade for the last...
Well, the free trade itself is a big joke. There's no free trade. Where's all the trade coming? It's coming in, not going out.
Well, yeah, but they make them cheaper, and some people say they make them better.
So the profit is bigger, and that's why they're doing it.
Ted, we've got it. We hear you loud and clear, and we thank you for your call. We wish you good luck. Ralph is calling from Frederick, Maryland. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How are you?
We're good. What do you think, Ralph?
Well, my feeling about the automobile industry is that it's been on a decline because their product hasn't been as good as the competition's. If you don't produce a quality product that can compete with the competition, people are going to buy the quality product.
So whose fault is it that American cars for a long time now have suffered that reputation?
Well, I think Toyota, Honda, some of the other car manufacturers out there, they have quality reputations. The American manufacturers just don't. They produce a product, maybe you can drive it for 100,000 miles or 150 maybe. But I have an Isuzu Rodeo with 300,000 miles on it. I've never had a major repair on it.
Wow, that's a lot of miles, Ralph. We appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. Don, what about it? I mean, we had decades here. This is not news that the quality wasn't there. What is American management's responsibility here? I mean, people have been in the plants doing the work for all those years, but they didn't design the cars.
Right.
So?
Well, I think this... The person that just called in was quite accurate. A lot of this is about product. The Japanese have been producing great products for a number of years. Now, it's not as if I wouldn't hit GM and Ford too much on this. It's true that some of their products have not been as good, but they have had some good products over the years. Their quality has been improving significantly, but the Japanese have raised the bar. There's no question about that. And to some extent, yeah, management is at fault here. Their products, the American products, have improved significantly.
But, you know, but the Japanese have raised the bar, and if you don't go up with it, we all know what happens. I mean, it sounds as though you're talking positively, but the bottom line doesn't seem to be a winning bottom line. It's not good enough to be better, but not good enough.
Well, that's true. The results are in the data. The market shares have declined significantly.
What would you do to lay down a prescription here? I mean, Ralph and Ted say close the borders. If you want to buy them here, make them here. Others are saying we've got to tear up these old labor contracts. Delphi cut wages by two-thirds, major American auto parts manufacturer. Right. Others are saying we need to remake American health care at the federal level so we take the burden off the shoulders of these companies. What would you do?
Well, I wouldn't close the borders. I mean, it's hard to stop free trade. I think what Ford is doing, I think Walter was quite accurate in saying that Ford has to, the U.S. companies have to match capacity better. I mean, not only does that create direct problems, but the extra overhead of all this extra capacity increased costs greatly.
But the main reason they have too much capacity is they're not selling enough
vehicles. The market share is going down.
So
we don't know what the ultimate market share of GM and Ford are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can match capacity to those ultimate shares, they can be profitable.
But that's a different thing than being a bulwark of the nation's manufacturing sector. They could be profitable with 15 employees.
But
you see what I mean.
Right.
You could cut it until you're profitable, but that doesn't mean you could call it a success story from the nation's point of view.
Well, if, again, I think that the auto industry will continue to stay robust because of the farming.
What do you mean, continue to? Oh, you mean across all
across the
Japanese,
board. Right,
Korean?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but, okay, yeah. And still, it's those American companies that we thought we were going to count on, at least at one time. Chris is calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. Chris, get on your phone. The speaker's too nasty.
Can you hear me now?
Much better. Thank you. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I agree with what everyone is saying, basically. I have to say, if you want to talk specifically about the auto industry, we could, but you could look at auto manufacturers in formerly post-industrial countries such as Germany, Sweden.
You're calling Germany post-industrial? I don't know if BM and Daimler Chrysler.
I would definitely say Germany is definitely post-smokestack industrial, and that's what we're talking about here. I don't think America will ever return to being a smokestack industrial heavy hitter. I think this, the world economy is such now that major manufacturers are going to go where labor is cheapest.
Can we live, can we have an acceptable standard of living and growth without that major manufacturing? Smokestack or not, it could be green, but...
And your question is, can we do that?
Yeah, can we live with that?
No, I don't think this country, in its current population form, current demographics, can sustain what this sort of pie-in-the-sky standard of living, as you say. I don't think that standard of living can remain in this country as we've known it.
Pie in the sky, that sounds as though it's a myth, but Americans had it for a long time.
Okay.
Is it history?
Past tense.
Past tense.
Absolutely.
And I mean, are you a quitter?
No, I'm just saying that populations change and move. I mean, look at the immigration to this country when it was the heavy hitter. Now populations will move elsewhere, whether it's India or China or wherever. Mexico.
But we've still got huge immigration inflows. Why can't this country get it together to harness those with all the know-how and all the willingness here and win?
We do harness a great deal of it in those lower-level service sector jobs.
Yeah.
That's what immigrants are coming here to get. That's a great job.
Grab a mop, but it doesn't sound too good. Chris, thanks for your call. Don, here's a grim view again. People are hearing you say we can win in particular industries, maybe, but is it enough to float this country's boat?
I don't know what the future brings, but if we can continue to innovate in certain industries, we can maintain our standard of living.
Across the board, not just for a few.
Well...
Because we're not doing that lately. The median income growth, down.
Right. Income variation will continue to increase. That's a natural outgrowth of the global economy. But if we can continue to make inroads in a number of manufacturing industries, we can the standard of living can go up. If we don't and jobs continue to go offshore, then we won't.
We're joined right now from Bradenton, Florida, by Donald Grimes. He's Senior Research Associate with the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations at the University of Michigan. Donald Grimes, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So a lot of Americans looking at the Ford news this week, and it's not the first time, and it may not be the last we've seen this kind of big cuts in automotive, but people really worried at this point about the future of the U.S. economy. If it's going to be smaller, maybe more productive, but not with as many jobs or as many American jobs, is there something else that picks up the slack here? Are we still looking to services? Can that do it?
Well, we could have been having this conversation in the early 1980s or the early 1990s.
Well, absolutely, and that's why it's scary to have it now.
No. But exactly the same questions were raised. There were people talking about it in the early 1980s and the early 1990s, and... Every time, it's always this worry that we will not be able to recover, we will not be able to get our economy to grow, we will not have an increase in standard of living because we're losing all these manufacturing jobs. And in each case, the next decade after that turned out to be one of rising standard of living for the United States in aggregate and great expansion of opportunity in this country.
In aggregate,
in each case,
yeah.
We're wrong. And why do you think that we're going to have a different outcome now, just because we're having this conversation,
well, listen,
than we did in 1990 or 91 or 1982. I didn't talk to you in those time periods.
Right.
We would have been having exactly the same conversation.
We hear that, and I hope that it's rosy and beautiful and coming up tulips, but these numbers are bad, and during just that period that you described, the median income has barely budged. So in aggregate, yes, we've got growth. But it's not getting spread around through good wages in the way that Americans are accustomed to. We've heard a lot of alarm about that. It seems that good manufacturing jobs were one way that happened. Can that happen without manufacturing? Are we positioned to regain jobs that pay that way, to millions of households?
Well, there's no question. I mean, if you're talking about Ford and GM and in the auto industry versus the other domestic auto producers, there's no question that Ford and GM, which are represented, which have to deal with the UAW, which have a unionized workforce, are losing market share to the non-unionized Toyota and Honda and Nissan and European producers in this country.
What do you take from that? Do we have to drop unions and union-level wages?
Well, the UAW either has to unionize those foreign producers and has to do it virtually immediately, or else the UAW has to cut contracts with GM and Ford that allows them to compete with the non-union producers.
If they unionize the foreign producers, won't they just go home, back to Japan, back to Korea,
yeah,
one day China?
Yeah, but then you get the international currency movements and so forth that'll work in your favor. The problem that GM and Ford face is that they cannot compete with domestically produced foreign-owned vehicles. So the foreign ownership of the mm-hmm. company vehicles, you know, that's where they're losing ground. It's the parts production that Delphi and Visteon are facing. It's not just parts that are coming in from overseas. In fact, very few come in from China to this day. It is parts that are produced by non-union facilities in the United States. It's a problem within the United States between unionized automakers and unionized auto parts makers and non-union auto industry. Now, that's a little different than looking at what's happening to manufacturing overall.
Yes.
But that's the issue, and nobody has been talking about that amongst your guests, and that's Ford and GM's problem, is it's a labor problem.
But you're probably not going to unionize Toyota, and if that means dropping unions or just dropping wages and benefits among Americans with American manufacturers, what does that mean? Does it mean we're simply accepting a lower standard of living?
The workers at GM and Ford are going to have to accept a lower standard of living or a lot fewer jobs. Those are the choices for the unionized workers at GM, Ford, and especially the parts producers, Visteon and Delphi.
If we organize this country differently, or maybe just those companies, couldn't we compete our way past that? I mean, that doesn't seem like an American path to simply accept a lower standard of living.
Well, it's going to be a lower standard of living for some workers, but overall, the country's standard of living in aggregate continues to grow.
Median income growth, not so.
Introduce certain distributional issues, but the truth is that the guys who worked for GM and Delphi and Visteon and Ford made extraordinary wages. I mean, those wages for those factory workers in those plants, I don't think people understand how high they are relative to the average worker in the United States.
That's part of the
those
way
guys were making and women who were working in those plants were making wages that put them in the top 10 or 20%. In order to get a comparable wage in the rest of the economy, you'd probably need a master's degree or more.
It's part of the way we understood the country, I guess. Now we're recalibrating, but I'm not sure we like it. Ed's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Ed, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Ed?
You know, I think that Americans have always been the innovators in the world. And I think where specifically companies like Ford and the other big three went wrong in this country was when they stopped listening to what Americans really wanted. Americans have been clamoring and demanding and begging for alternative energies and hybrid vehicles and solar power since the 70s.
Americans bought an awful lot of great big SUVs in the 90s. Was it just because that what they made? I felt an appetite there.
They did, but you have to understand that the reason we're talking about Toyota and Honda is because they're taking the lead in terms of quality and energy efficiency. People are beginning to realize that we cannot continue to consume the way we're consuming now. And Americans are behind the curve in terms of technology because we haven't been listening to our better instincts. We've been fighting each other.
So now you've got William Clay Ford Jr., CEO at Ford, saying he wants to get on the green beam here. Do you think Americans can do it? American companies can do it, Ed?
I think American companies can do it, and we will do it in the future, but we have to take a more long-term vision and less short-term approach. And that's something that Japan has and countries like China have.
Ed, we've got it. We appreciate your call from Alexandria. I want to get another call in here, if I may, from Des Moines, Iowa. Bill is calling. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to echo some of what Ed said, I think, in that America has traditionally been very innovative, and I think this is an opportunity where we are going to need to step up to the plate and lead industrial countries in the next phase. And we're going to have to reinvent ourselves, I think. As what you guys were touching upon, I don't know that we can compete in the labor market with some of these other countries because of how cheap it is. And so I think we need to reinvent what do we provide to the world economy and how do we do it? And I think it's going to take investment and particularly education.
Bill, do you think America can reinvent itself in such a way that it maintains its standard of living and keeps it growing?
I believe we can, but I think conversations like this are a good starting point. And I don't think we can just sit back and let it happen. I think we really need to be very aggressive and be the innovators that we have historically been, and really take that initiative and try to reinvent with it. I don't know what that is.
Bill, we've got it. Let me put it to my guest, and thank you for your call. Don Rosenfield, when Henry Ford stepped up and kind of invented the automobile industry, there's an example of super innovation in the United States. The thing itself, the mass production, it put us out in front for a long, long time, and it brought some, as Donald Grimes says, it brought some great wages in its trail. Are there, if we're not winning that way in the automotive business, are there other manufacturing businesses where we might have that kind of breakthrough again, put Americans way out front? Or is that history now, when countries around the world have decent education and have PhDs in engineering out of American universities? Is that kind of super advantage just lost, gone?
Well, the last caller put it, expressed it correctly. We can't compete on the global labor market. If we're going to compete in the global labor market, the standard of living is going to go down. We have to make these innovations in these other industries, or else the standard of living will go down.
Is it happening? Can you point to some
examples?
Well,
there has been some innovation in certain industries. We've certainly done well in biotech. We've done well in semiconductors. To some extent, we've done well in aerospace.
But I saw Airbus sold more planes than Boeing last year.
Well, that's true, but just barely. And Boeing, Boeing.
We were the boss in that industry.
Right. But Boeing has actually come back pretty well the last year.
Okay,
they've banked a lot of orders. Their new airplane is very innovative.
So biotech, although it should maybe be aerospace. What else?
Semiconductors. Mm-hmm. Certainly, a company like Intel has been in the forefront of manufacturing. We don't know where these industries might come from in the future, but we absolutely have to be innovative.
Are we positioned to be as or more innovative than Japan, than China, than Korea, than India, or not?
Well, we still have the best university system. And
what about K-12?
Well, not as strong as some other countries.
What about fundamental research in our university system?
It's still in reasonably good shape.
Okay, good, good. Donald Grimes, if we do grab the lead in the kind of industries that Don Rosenfield's talking about there, can we keep growth going, not just for in aggregate, but for, you know, ordinary American families? Can we maintain a standard of living and boost it on the backs of those industries?
I believe we can. I believe that ordinary Americans will continue to enjoy the fruits of our growing standard of living, although it will vary by different individuals. The returns to education and training will go up, so that the people who get associate's degrees will begin to get more of a return to that degree, and the people who are basically able to get higher wages because they worked for unionized manufacturing firms are going to get lower wages. There's going to be a distributional change within who gets the middle class wages.
Already has been.
Yes, already has been, and it's going to continue.
And that middle class has gotten thinner, and I guess that's part of the concern here. Evelyn's calling from Boston. Hi, Evelyn, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The point I want to make is I think that your guest is putting a little bit too much faith in the service sector growing. I'm a software engineer with a large financial institution, and by September, half of my group is going to be gone, and our jobs are going to be replaced by workers in India. And I don't know if I'm going to be affected, but if I am, I can tell you how we will handle it, and that is by lowering our standard of living.
When you say we, you mean you and your colleagues or your family?
No, sorry, my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I also probably will be doing a lot of work for free at my children's school.
Evelyn, where do you see the future? If it's not in your corner of the service industry, we see what's going on at Ford. We hope they turn around, but as just an educated American looking out there, where do you see the future?
Well, I mean, talking about the service industry, you know, I'm highly educated and technical, but there are a lot of other services like call centers that are also going overseas. But I hope that we can continue to be innovative. I do think that there is a lot of waste in this country, and I think that, you know, if in my family, if we have to tighten our belt a bit, you know, we'll still have, God willing, we'll have our clothing and shelter and food and everything like that.
That sounds like a minimal prayer in the American tradition, Evelyn, but we wish you luck with it. Let me get a call from Charleston, South Carolina. Michael's on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that Well, firstly, regarding the automobile industry, I think there was a lot that the government has slept on in this country. For instance, would it not have done the whole industry a favor if they had instituted really strict air
emission standards? Yeah.
Yeah, that would have forced the automobile industry to innovate a long time ago. So I think Europeans and Asians had a step up there. The other thing is just politics in general, how the government regulates industry. It always seems to take so long to get things done. And
but isn't that industry's job to step up and get things done? I mean, government's not going to be the innovator ultimately.
Well, I think that's a general problem in the country, is industry makes decisions based on profits, and the people working for them only actually stand up and say something about their lot when things are going bad. Now things are going bad, and so maybe industry will step up and say, we need to move things at a lot faster pace.
Maybe even at the level of national policy. Michael, thanks very much for your call. Don Rosenfeld, I see you leaning in there. Are you looking for the U.S. government to create a different environment, to be more engaged? Is it doing enough? Is it awake at the switch here?
Well, the government certainly has some role, and certainly governmental policy can encourage and do the right things for manufacturing.
But, like what? On what fronts?
Well, just in terms of encouraging investments, and in terms of, certainly free trade policies. But the role supporting education. Mm-hmm. But I think the role is limited. I think that certainly regulation will have a role in the automobile industry. But I believe that fundamentally it's the companies themselves that have to be innovating.
And what about those companies? What do you hear from management? I mean, we saw the numbers last year, companies taking a lot of these profits and buying back their own stock. And we saw Wall Street analysts saying this is not a good sign. They shouldn't be buying back their stock. They should be investing in innovative new technologies and production facilities. Is American industry, manufacturing itself, sanguine about the future?
Well, it varies by industry, but some industries invest more than others, and certainly some of the better managed companies are devoting a healthy percentage to R&D.
Donald Grimes, if you could step into the boardroom or the cabinet room in Washington, what big policy focus would you suggest here?
Well, from a national policy perspective, I do believe that we essentially need national health insurance. There's going to be a lot of transition as we go through this manufacturing process of transformation of workers. Even callers like Evelyn, who are potentially facing a loss of their job and therefore would be temporarily displaced. I believe that we need a national safety net. Particularly in the area of health insurance, which now is tied to your job.
So there's a big one, and that's a big issue for Detroit.
That's a big issue, but I think that would change perhaps people's perspective and their fear of this transformation that's going on more than anything else that could happen. Because it's the fear of the transformation that I think your callers are concerned about. I have absolutely no doubt that we will end up better off in the long run, and I think any serious examiner of history would show that. But in the meantime, people are going to suffer a lot and are going to, and especially if the fear if they don't have national some sort of a health insurance program for their kids. And I think that we need to have national policy that provides an adequate safety net so that we can go forward with the transformation with a positive attitude instead of a fearful one.
We want to have exactly that positive attitude. We thank you for bringing it. Donald Grimes at the University of Michigan, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye.
And Don Rosenfeld from MIT Sloan School and the Engineering Systems Division. Don, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.